Garrett Edelstein here, your celeb expert and your celeb savant. Celeb Savant is a weekly entertainment show. We have long-form career retrospective type interviews with celebrities, singers, actors, and industry experts. On this episode of Celeb Savant, I'll be speaking to Nick DeCosimo. With over 30 years' experience in music and media, Nick has worked on some of the world's biggest editorial lifestyle brands. He currently works for Wasted Talent Media in the position of Global Editorial Director at Mixmag, the world's biggest, longest-standing, and most respected electronic music and club culture brand. He has spent the last decade launching Mixmag in numerous locations around the world, including LA, New York, Johannesburg, Mumbai, and Goa, plus helping to relaunch the iconic youth lifestyle magazine, The Face, to international acclaim. A veteran musician, he is also a DJ, producer, and vocalist, having released records on labels including Warner Music Group, Universal Music, Classic, Eskimo, Perfecto, and a full-length album on Atlantic Records. Nick is also co-founder of the lauded SXM Festival, a boutique electronic music event on the Caribbean island of St. Martin. This is Celeb Savant with Nick DeCosimo. Hey, so this is Celeb Savant, Barrett Edelstein, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing or chatting with Nick DeCosimo. Nick, how are you? How's your life? Where do we find you today?
I'm great. I am here in Johannesburg. I've been here for almost 3 months with work, and the sun is shining, and yeah, I'm leaving in 5 days, which I'm a little sad about because I love South Africa and I love being in Joburg. But yeah, I'm in good spirits and looking forward to the next challenge and the next little adventure in my strange and twisted, complicated life.
So for the listening audience, I met Nick in the Golden Circle at the Johnny Clegg concert. For our international listeners who may not know Johnny Clegg, he was a very famous South African artist. He passed away a few years ago, and it was a tribute concert to him and his music and his legacy. So Nick and I were just standing there, and we started chatting, like I do with loads of people. And now he's here, and I'm interviewing him. So Nick, there are three areas I'd like to focus on. First of all, music career. Tell us more about that.
Well, just to step back a bit, I guess I've worked in kind of music and media my whole life, pretty much. I started DJing like age 14 at school parties. I used to play in school bands, you know, all of this kind of stuff. I grew up in the northeast of England in the UK. And then I went to college and university in Scotland. So that was kind of my background. And I was always interested in music. I used to put on parties, used to promote nights. It's kind of how I paid my way through university. And alongside that, I was doing a degree in English literature. So I was interested in writing, and I actually went on to kind of have a career in journalism, in like music journalism and lifestyle journalism. My current main gig, I guess, is my main job is Global Editorial Director of Mixmag, which was Mixmag was one of the first electronic music, dance music, DJ culture magazines. It was launched in the 80s. I used to read it religiously as like a young kind of raver, you know, in the 90s. And so I went through university. I studied. I was very lucky to get a job at like a pop magazine when I graduated, but I always made music as a hobby. I was DJing, producing, I was singing, and I was lucky enough to go to school with a musical genius, a guy called Anu Pillai, who was one of my best friends, and we were in a school band together. And over time, he kind of like forged a career in music, and I started to guest, like, just, you know, we were in a band together at school. I was a singer. He's like, Nick, I need a vocalist. You know, do you want to come in? And we just did some stuff like informally. This is like when by this point, I'd moved to London, and I was like living and working in London on sort of different kind of lifestyle magazines, and did music as a hobby. But Anna was just incredibly talented. So, and we had a bit of kind of chemistry, and I guess I got lucky enough to kind of ride his coattails. And we released on some very cool underground electronic music labels, one label in particular, which was called Classic. And I sang on a few of these tracks, did some guest vocals, we did some remixes, and it kind of grew. And and then we got signed to Warner Brothers, like, it's almost kind of out of the blue. This is in like early 2000s.
Okay.
So I was still working as a music journalist at the same time. So I had this bizarre double life where I was sort of in this band. The band had expanded. There was like two or three singers. We were, I don't know, what were we? We were kind of quite ahead of our time. It was very eclectic, electronic, kind of multi-race, you know, quite sort of gender fluid. A bit like, I don't know, we got compared to the Scissor Sisters, I guess. But okay. we were like more and a slightly less pop. And yeah, we made... Anu made this amazing album that I was lucky enough to sing on a few songs. And and at the same time, I was working as like a music and fashion journalist. It was a very bizarre time. I was still pretty young. I was only like 28. I was working on a couple of men's magazines. I was doing stuff like I did Beyonce's first cover after she split from Destiny's Child. Covers like Shakira's first European cover. I used to go and book the covers and then kind of art direct them. And then at the same time, I'm in this sort of weird, like, underground electronic music act. So in retrospect, it was quite crazy, actually. I was like 26, 27. I'd be flying to LA one week to meet with like bloody Jennifer Lopez's agent, and then I come back to be like doing tours and like these grotty kind of flea pits. And yeah, so we went through the major label system, released the album. I got some amazing opportunities. I worked with Vince Clark, who obviously started Depeche Mode and Yazoo and Erasure, and was like literally my all-time childhood hero. So I co-wrote and sang on a song written and co-produced by him, Anu, and Martin Ware, who was the founder of Heaven 17, also yep. like a electronic music legend. Weirdly, I was at college with Snow Patrol, the indie band. We were all friends. This is so funny. Like, these are all just mates. It's funny how these things happen in life. Gary, the lead singer, obviously were very, very close at university and afterwards. So he co-wrote a song that I sang on the album. And then like just a bunch of other people. That album was amazing. There were all kinds of just like, and it just brought together this kind of amazing kind of Jamaican dancehall MC called Bounty Killer, who's like legendary yep. kind of like dancehall.
Yep.
Who else? Oh, goodness me. There was Jimmy Douglas, who was like this legendary mix engineer who'd done all kinds of, he used to work with Pharrell. I think he did the Rolling Stones at one point. Bunch of people. I was just this kid that got thrown into this exciting adventure, and we ended up releasing, and I was a bit player in it. Listen, I just felt lucky to, like, you know, to get to kind of even just sing on any of these yeah. songs, get to work with some of these people. And the album ended up coming out on Atlantic Records because Warner Brothers had just re-released it. And this was like, I don't know, early, goodness me, this is like early 2000s. And long story short, it just didn't go very well with the major label, and we went through the ringer and ups and downs. And it was at a time, especially in UK music, where electronic music and dance music was in a bit of a dip.
Yeah.
You know, social media hadn't really taken off. It was hard to promote. If you were part of a subculture or a niche thing, it was a little more difficult to promote. You had to have backing from Radio One. There were a lot of politics.
Yeah.
We were in this major label system where we'd gone from like quite sort of light, fleet of foot, sort of independent. So we got lost a little bit in there. And also as well, I think Anu made this, I listened to the album again. The album is called Strangest Things by a band called Freeform 5. I'd recommend people go and check it. I listened again, I played a small part on it, but I listened to it again and like, it's a masterpiece. What he did was just absolutely incredible to bring all these different elements together. But I think we found ourselves, it divided opinion when it came out. We'd come from quite an underground club background, and people in that world, especially back then, they knew what they liked and what they thought was cool and what wasn't cool.
Yeah.
And then we came up with this album that was like, it was kind of like a very cool pop album, but it wasn't pop enough for the pop people, and it wasn't underground enough for the under, and it fell somewhere in the middle. Add into that the fact that, you know, like, I remember we were, God, who were our label mate? Like, James Blunt was the biggest artist on Warner Brothers at that time.
Okay.
But don't get me wrong, James Blunt's an absolute legend. I don't know if you follow his Twitter account or whatever. I mean, he's hilarious.
I've seen him in concert.
He's amazing.
And he's amazing. He's hysterical.
But let's be honest, you know, the music, well, you know, was pretty sort of wet, like indie ballady type stuff.
Yeah.
You know, Snow Patrol were huge. Like the Kooks, you know, it was a lot of like indie guitar. The Darkness were our other, again, who were a brilliant, fun band. But we were in this place of like this quite cool, slightly complex sort of crossover pop electronic, don't really know what it was, uncategorizable album. And I think just people couldn't kind of, they just couldn't wrap their heads around it. A young Amy Winehouse was also our label mate. She'd just been signed for that album Frank, which was her very first album, where it was pre like the Amy that came afterwards.
Yeah.
And she was still finding her feet. I think she was, if you see like the album artwork for that, she's very manicured and like kind of clean. And I think she was sort of put through the major label system.
Yeah.
But yeah, she was a label mate at the time. Funny story, I used to do, because I kind of navigated these different worlds of, because I was still working in media at the time, so I was editing fashion magazines and all this sort of stuff. So I used to do, as well as like the kind of proper gigs and shows, I used to play like corporate parties or, you know, whatever, for like a fragrance brand or whatever, you know, this kind of
stuff.
As a DJ. Yeah, you know, because I love music. It was a paying gig. It was fun. I remember I got booked for this gig in Camden. I think it was like a fragrance or some beauty company. Got booked to do this gig. And it was like quite small. It was fun. It was like, okay, Nick, you know, you'll go on. And then, then Amy Winehouse is going to come on and sing a few songs. And I was like, fucking Amy Winehouse. I was like, because at this point, she just disappeared after that first album.
Yeah.
Like nobody like seen or heard of her for, I don't know, a long time. And I was like, Amy Winehouse. I was like, oh my goodness. I was like, so did the DJ set and was finishing, turned down. And this creature appeared with the hair and the tattoos. And like, I think it was possibly one of the first, like, it was the first time I'd seen her. I hadn't seen her for over a year or whatever. Yeah. I'd seen her at like a Warner Brothers Christmas party or something, you know? Yeah, she just, this creature appeared of like with the beehive and the you know, the hot pants and all the tattoos, and like started singing. She had a guitarist, and it was a lot of the, you know, that early style and, you know, that she became like renowned for. Yeah. And I was just like, wow, what has happened here, man? This is incredible. So anyway, sorry, that's a little digression. But so I got to live this, you know, I'm a working class boy from like a mining town in the northeast of England. Came from pretty humble beginnings, but man, I've been lucky to get to do some of the stuff that I got to do. And so I was living in London. The Warner Brothers experience didn't work particularly well. We got dropped. We got spat out the other end. I was still doing my journalism stuff. I was living in West London, like near to like Ladbroke Grove and Notting Hill. So near like Psalm Studios, where everything from like Grace Jones's, you know, Slave to the Rhythm was recorded there. It's like legendary. So I was living in this area where there was just naturally a massive musical heritage. Loads of sort of that 90s, it was like a tail end of quite a golden age for that part of London before things started to gravitate a little bit more east.
Okay.
And yeah, just got to make friends just like by hanging out in pubs and bars and stuff, like with some of these like amazing, amazing people. And then our band, Freeform 5, we got the album back. It got re-released on its cool German label called Fine, along with all of the remixes. It did quite well. And there was one song in particular, which is a remix. I don't know if you've heard of an artist called Milo. I don't know if this guy was big here, but in the early 2000s, his album, you might know, Motherfucker Gonna Drop the Pressure.
Yeah, of course, yes. Yeah.
So Miles was a friend from Scotland. He sort of restarted the electronic music, the dance music scene in the UK on the back of this album. It's called Destroy Rock and Roll. And it became huge. And we collaborated. Freeform 5 did a remix of one of his songs, which is called Muscle Car, which ended up on the album. And then we kind of did this tour together. And he did a remix of one of our songs, which is called No More Conversations, which was this like kind of an early electro house kind of big dance floor song. Anyway, basically just took on it, grew and grew and grew and grew. And it kind of became like one of the, for a couple of years, like in the early 2000s, it was like the biggest dance music song in the world. It was quite crazy to see it happen. So all of a sudden, the phone started ringing again for the band and we started to get booked. And we toured Australia, we played Belgium, we went all over Europe. We were getting all of these kind of big kind of club gigs again. And it was like, oh, okay, right, here we go. And then Universal picked the record up and signed it. for like a one-off deal with a view to like doing an album.
Yeah.
So we were all like, I was like, you know, like, okay, so are we doing this again then? All right. And it was there that the it was, God, what was the imprint? The imprint was called Apollo. It was headed up by a guy called Matt Jagger, who was this quite mercurial figure in the UK sort of dance music scene. And he'd done two previous records. I think one was DJ Mech, and the other one was the re-release. I remember that Elton John song, Are You Ready for Love?
Yes.
Are you ready for love? So that was a reissue of a 70s track that he's done, the disco track that he'd done. And
that went to number one, I think.
Both records on this imprint, Apollo, had gone to number one. And again, everybody at Universal, like, you're going to have a number one record, guys. Get ready to be famous. So I was like, okay, well, we'll believe it when we see it. And anyway, long story short, they fucked it up.
How?
There was some back and forth with Radio 1. There was some stuff going on with the video. There was some internal politics. It's the music industry, man. You know, how do you, you know, it didn't happen. And like, we were like number 20 or something like that. So then
20 is still good.
Yeah. I mean, it's not as good as number one. So we got dropped again. And at this point, I was like, Anu was just like, I'm going to take some time off. I mean, Anu has gone on to be a very, very successful music producer. He wrote and co-produced, I think, you know, Lewis Capaldi? You know,
yeah, of course he is.
So he wrote and co-produced a lot of the big hits, I think, from, I'm not sure if it's the first or second album, does stuff with Roisin Murphy, Little Boots, but he's a genius, you know? So, but he was like, I need to rest. And I still had my, I was editing a fashion magazine at the time. And literally in the same week I was getting dropped by Universal, the fashion mag got closed down and I got made redundant. And I was like sat at home twiddling my thumbs going, oh, okay. Oh, is this done well? Well, I've had a good run of luck, maybe, like, you know. And I was temping. I was helping my friend, was editing a men's fashion magazine called Arena. And I was sat there sort of licking my wounds, deputizing for him. He'd just been made editor of Arena. And he was like, you know, Nick, he's like, you know, Mixmag are looking for a editor. This is 2007. And I swear to God, I was like, fuck off. I was like, I was going to be on the cover of Mixmag 2 months ago. So I was like, I guess I saw it as a bit of a step down. He's like, Nick, you do two things. You make dance music and you edit magazines. You should go and speak to them.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah. So I sent an email and I think they'd already just about appointed like a new editor. And literally the managing director, Jerry, he called me in and we had like a 20-minute chat. And he was like, look, if you want the job, it's yours.
So what happened to the other person?
I never found out who it was, but I think it was somebody on my team. And over time, I earned his respect and we became very, very good friends. And he went on to become a pretty successful music producer as well.
Okay.
So, yeah. So, and then I started like literally a week later.
So just going back to the music. It's similar to the way David Guetta and all these other DJs are doing their music now. Kygo, you know, collaborating with different artists. Do you think that you guys were before the time?
I mean, okay. So first, I mean, there's a few things. I can't overestimate my contribution to this because my friend Anu, it really kind of his project. And I was the guest vocalist, helped a bit with like ideas for production and whatnot. So that's the first thing. Secondly, I think, you know, collaboration has always been a big part of dance music since its birth.
Yeah.
So if you go back to like Chicago House or whatever, you know, a lot of it was all guest vocals, you know, loads of collaborations with a lot of gospel swingers from the, you know, from the American church or different players. So I think the collaboration aspect has been in the DNA of dance music from the start, I guess, because of just how the music is made as well. It's rare. I mean, you do have like now bands who also collaborate and make dance music, but when dance music really, really kind of took off, so like the mid 80s onwards, you know, it was like solo or producers or production duos who worked in a studio.
Yeah.
They made the tracks, whoever it is, Frankie Knuckles, Masters at Work, David Morales, you know, all of these kind of classic American house music names. they would make the tracks and then they would bring a vocalist in. Yeah. Or maybe they'd bring a bass player in to do a bass session or so. It wasn't a band in a room coming up with, you know, in the way that like the Beatles or whatever, or Earth, Wind & Fire, I don't know, mate, would kind of produce their music. So I think that that spirit of collaboration has always been like a key part of the culture. I think Freeform 5 were ahead of our time for a UK act anyway, because what Anu did quite marvelously was contribute a lot, combine a lot of live instrumentation with electronic stuff and programming, which wasn't happening quite so much, especially not in the UK. You had acts like Masters at Work, Mondo Grosso, different sort of acts like American or Japanese acts in the 90s were doing it, but it wasn't really happening so much in the UK. So I think from that perspective, without a doubt, like Anu was definitely ahead of his time.
But in the beginning, they would collaborate with lesser known artists. Mm. Whereas when I think David Guetta was the first one to start with, you know,
he did the stuff with will.i.am, which was big. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, there were, I think what happened, I mean, listen, David became huge, you know, he's a bit of a divisive character in the dance music world, because people, you know, he's sold out or he's too big, or a nicer fella you'd never meet. He's an absolute sweetheart. And you have to give him credit and respect for what he's done and what he's achieved. It's pretty mad. The length and breadth of his career is quite astonishing. I think what happened was he was there when American hip hop finally started to take notice of dance music. So this is like mid-noughties, I guess. will.i.am from the Black Eyed Peas jumped on it. Then all of a sudden you had, you know, Good and Bad, like crossover tracks where American, previously either hip-hop, rap or R&B artists were collaborating with European, mainly like electro kind of house, it was slightly on the more commercial side of it. And you had this new kind of hybrid sound, which became, I mean, it was, you know, it was huge for a long time, you know. I mean, it brought what you would call European dance music to an, until then, a new kind of, black American audience, or not the audience, or lovers of like, you know, black Americans, hip hop, R&B, you know, and rap music. I mean, of course, the irony is house music and Detroit techno were created in the US, but they were seen as, it was niche music. It never, it was big in New York. It was big in Detroit. It was big in LA.
Chicago,
it was big in New
well?
York. Chicago is where house music was born, house music. But it was quite a gay, black, niche, underground kind of movement. It wasn't until, we call it like the EDM explosion happened, and the music came back to the US from Europe in many forms. But your average American punter had no idea, you know. They just thought, well, techno is it's a white German European thing,
or Dutch, yeah,
or Dutch, which is irony. And that, and this led to, I mean, it's led to quite a lot of conflict actually, because I think, because I'm a bit older, and obviously I grew up with it, so I just assumed like, well, of course house music is black gay American musical, of course Detroit techno was created by, you know, a niche underground scene of like black visionaries in Detroit. But you know, if you're a 15 year old kid from Antwerp or a 15 year old kid from Kansas and you're only hearing it, then you might not have that perspective. So there was quite it was during the Black Lives Matter movement and stuff, you know, there was quite a lot of friction. There wasn't the recognition amongst a lot of the new fans about what the history of this was, and a lot of black artists were like, Justify, be pretty pissed off about it.
Yeah,
so it's interesting. So my job at Mixmag, when I became editor, obviously, like I said, Mixmag was like the Bible for all of this kind of stuff. And we've been telling these stories. I remember reading these stories in the 90s. It was all about black America, house, gospel. You know, that was where this sound came from. So it was always in my DNA. But again, if you come through the pipeline through social media or whatever thing else, or you're not as passionate about it, you might not know about it. So we actually, at Mixmag and quite a lot of other publications, kind of went on a bit of an education mission to kind of re-educate a lot of the new fans about the history of this music and sort of, you know, where it fits in. And that was part of the wider narrative about, you know, the Black Lives Matter and movement, and telling some of these stories that I guess someone like me, this is my bad, has just made the assumption of thinking, well, of course people should know this. So we made a concerted effort to at least try and shine a spotlight on some of that historical stuff. Which we still do. I think it's spearheaded now. I mean, my role at Mixmag is a bit more, I'm like the mad uncle who gets to travel the world and do these like event series and meet amazing people. But I've got a great team of pretty, very conscious and kind of motivated younger staff members who are incredibly thoughtful, actually. It's great to get to sort of talk to them and get their perspectives on stuff. Because I'm in my late 40s now. So when I get to travel, I get to meet amazing people. But, you know, there's still a bit of a distance between that and maybe your core demographic. So it's good to have input from those guys. None of this music is created in a vacuum, you know, and that Chicago House is a specific sound with a specific history, with specific players that help contribute to that. But obviously they were influenced by Kraftwerk, or they were influenced by a lot of the New Romantic acts, Depeche Mode, a lot of the European kind of synth acts, but they were also influenced by the legacy of disco and soul music. And the church, you know. But then all of that came together at this beautiful time and a place where there was mainly black, Hispanic, gay, hedonistic culture. The technology, the entry level for price came down to a certain level that it meant that more people could afford the basic equipment.
Okay.
And that, if that makes sense, right? Because if you look previous to that, you know, you're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars for even a basic, like a Fairlight synthesizer, for example, in the early 80s would cost $500,000 and only the Pet Shop Boys could use it or whatever. So the entry level came down. And then also you had literally some of the best singers in the world that grew up in the gospel church in the US. Then that music found its way to Ibiza and to Europe and to London. And that's where it exploded. It never blew up
in America
at that point. I remember going to see the likes of Frankie Knuckles, Tony Humphries, DJ Pierre, Felix the House Cat, all of these like iconic legendary names who were flying to Europe and to get paid. I mean, you know, and they were part of this mad scene that went from maybe 200 people in 1987 to 20,000 people in a field raving in 1988.
Yeah.
And then, you know, obviously the sound developed, combination in the UK of this new music, house music, this new drug, or not new drug, but this ecstasy and this kind of new style and fashion with the smiley faces. And that's where rave culture was born. I mean, again, it fractured and then it went off in all of these different directions. Hardcore, jungle, drum and bass, you know, acid house, I guess is what they call it. But I know a lot of the American originators of the sound of what they call it, they were horrified because they were all, some of them were quite religious. Yep. A lot of them just didn't do drugs at all. And then they landed in like a field in Southern England with like 20,000 Cockney kids off their faces, like dancing,
dressed up
in these bright colors. And like, you know, I remember them just saying like, what the hell is this, you know?
Tell us a little bit more about your role at Mixmag. What does that entail?
Basically, Mixmag, like I said, was the first kind of DJ culture magazine. It was launched in, was it 83 or 84? I'm going to say 84, but possibly 83. Shalimar were the first cover stars, which I'm pretty happy about because they're cool. And it was launched by a chap called Tony Prince, who was this kind of legendary. Have you heard of the DMC mixing championships, the DJ mixing championships? Yep. So he founded DMC and he used to do that. And he was a radio DJ. He was a big advocate of like early soul music and disco music getting played in the UK. He mentored like Pete Tong and like a lot of other, but like legendary character. It was Tony launched it as like a free sheet for kind of like mobile DJs. And it was a free sheet. And it basically, you know, it was pre-internet, social media, so it connected DJs and they could write in and ask questions. And, you know, they'd in the early days, they'd do stuff like, you know, like have like a, write an article about, is it acceptable to talk on the mic between records and all of this kind of stuff. It's brilliant. But it was very much also championing like what was left of disco, this new like electronic music, black soul music. Carl Cox used to contribute, you know, he was a soul DJ like back in the late 70s and early 80s. And then it took off. And then when the acid house thing happened, it became like the voice of the dance floor, basically. And in the 90s, it was like a super, super big deal. Everybody from, you know, Fatboy Slim, Carl Cox, the Chemical Brothers, Underworld, like all of those seminal, Sasha, like 90s sort of big kind of dance music, electronic music acts were on the cover. And I became editor in 2007. You know, if I'm honest, it was not the best time for magazines. Yep. It was a bit of a difficult time for dance music. We didn't really have a digital presence and a lot of magazines were closing. So yeah, I spent 4 or 5 years working in London, like basically trying to transfer to being a full like digital business with a website. We started to do events. We started to do early DJ streams. Yeah, we did. We launched a thing called the Mix Mag Lab, which is like our weekly DJ streaming show. And basically, it started off as it's quite a cool story, actually. In the 90s, a lot of these big DJs would they drop by the Mix Mag office on a Friday afternoon before they had a gig, like later on in London, and they'd just play records for the Mix Mag team, just to, like, vibe them up for the weekend. But Mix Mag on a Friday afternoon was like, you were so jealous that was the place to be. Like, normal, like Fatboy Slim would drop in and play some tunes and they'd be getting the beers in, God knows what else. I was like, okay, we're going to take that idea but relaunch it for the digital age. And we did the same thing, but then we had I said to Jerry, the MD, I was like, Jerry, I'm sorry, I'm kicking you out of your office. I'm turning it into a nightclub. He's like, well, I was like, trust me. So we painted this tiny room in the corner of the office. I mean, the first one, we literally had one GoPro. That was it. But the first five acts, so the first act were Orbital. Second one was Fatboy Slim. We had Disclosure, Solomon, Carl Cox. I can't remember that. It was ridiculous. And you can go back, you can find some of these streams online. Like, they're quite funny because it's literally, it was the early days of all the technology. It's just like one GoPro. Audio, quite decent audio. And we'd have, like, sometimes, you know, we'd have, like, Rudimental played and we had to go to press with a magazine. There was a problem. And I'm, like, proofreading pages trying to go to press. Remember one time there was some MC was just, like, in the corner. Everybody else is drinking and partying. And normally I'd be there, but sometimes if we had to go to press, we had to go to press. I remember, like, reading this proofreading this page and, like, nodding my head. And some MC was like, look at the editor! Like, shouting over. It's chaos. I mean, it was madness. What a joyous time. So 30, 40 people. Anyway, this idea just, it really took off. It got bigger and bigger. And then in 2013, I had an opportunity to go to America to launch the Mix Mag Lab there and then to launch Mix Mag in the US. So I did 2 years in LA. Really massive success. Then I did 4 years in New York. So we had an LA office, a New York office. We did the lab in LA, the Mix Mag Lab in New York. Bunch of other stuff. We had a big a bunch of offices, did a lot of activity in America. And then in early 2019, we'd just done this big, a global deal with Budweiser, where we were doing, it was amazing, these BudX activations that they do. Which, you know, like, hand on heart, were true. Like, I mean, they did some spectacular stuff. And I got to, like, we did, like, these BudX Cities events. So we did events in Tokyo, in Paris, where else? Ho Chi Minh City, you know, all over the world. And they also loved the Mix Mag Lab. And they were like, we'd like to do it in Johannesburg. So I was like, I'd been to South Africa once before because I've known Black Coffee for quite a long time because we, he did a Mix Mag cover, like, 10 years ago. And obviously you can't work in dance music and not know about the South African music scene.
Yeah.
And I'd actually came here in, oh my goodness, I think 2017. And I did a little mini documentary. It was a series called The Global Dance Floor. And it was like a series of little mini documentaries about like how dance music brings people together around the world. It was with Smirnoff actually when they were doing a lot. They were doing this equalizing music campaign where they were trying to tell different stories of sort of lesser told narratives and like the positivity of dance floor. Anyway, of dance music. And we interviewed Natty. So interviewed Black Coffee, DJ Fresh, and Tim White used to run the record shop that Black Coffee used to go in as a kid after school.
Oh, wow.
It was amazing. Yeah. So he used to go in a school uniform, listen to it's quite a famous, it was a famous record store. And DJ Fresh, obviously, is now a very famous broadcaster. He was a house music DJ. That guy's got charisma, man. I spent like an afternoon with him chatting. What a cat. He's amazing. And him, and I think at this point, dance music, you could only, it was huge. It was becoming, it was mainly imports. You know, there was a South African scene. You had Kwaito and you had your own scenes here, but no internet. If you wanted to listen to a track, you had to buy vinyl. And, you know, that came on an import. It was expensive. Anyway, they did this DJ Fresh compilation. It was one of the first CDs that had all of this music on it. And it was ridiculous. It like sold 100,000 copies in like a week or something. Like, it was this huge, huge success. It was Black Coffee's idea to tell the story about this. I think it was like, it was called like Fresh, DJ Fresh Volume 1. He wanted to tell his story because that was like almost the birth of Afro House in a way, because then it exploded. And obviously he had more and more kids in the townships had access to it, and or just like everywhere around the country. And again, the entry-level technology prices came down, and the level of talent that you have in this country is ridiculous anyway. So yeah, and that was like how it snowballed from there. And here we are now with Black Coffee's the world's biggest DJ and blah, 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 blah. So anyway, so yeah, so I had been here once briefly in 2017. I'd only been here for a short time. Absolutely loved it. I just had the best time. I think there's, I don't know, man. There's the Brit thing. There's a sense of humor thing that's connected. But I just, the food, the music, the people, like, I just fell in love with the place. And I had the opportunity to come back again in 2019. So I came and we did a 20-week run for the Mixed Mag Lab Johannesburg with Budweiser. I lived in Melville. It was before the pandemic, like particularly Melville at that time. For me, it just seemed like paradise. Like it was this cross-cultural, you know, it was that bustling, you know, the Melville strip. And it was just like, and after living in New York, and where, look, I love America. I love American culture and everything else, but it's different. And there's a lot of money involved. And the sentiment can be slightly, it's good and bad everywhere, but that constant rat racy, hey, what do you do type thing.
Yeah.
Coming to Joburg and living in Melville, and it was just like the antidote to that. And I was just like, I could spend like forever here. I just loved it. I loved it. So we did like this 20-week run. Then I went back to New York for a bit. And then the opportunity came to go to Mumbai to do the lab again with Budweiser. And in the back of my mind, I was like, okay, I'm fixing myself up here to not have to live in New York anymore, get to live this kind of blessed lifestyle where hopefully I can spend a bit of time in South Africa, a bit of time in India, and a bit of time in Europe, you know, in the not in suicide February in London, like, yeah, you know, yeah. Get to London when it's nice for the 3 weeks of summer that we have, you know, right?
When it's not a heat wave.
Well, yes, I know. Well, there you go. That's an irony. Anyway, so yes, I went to Mumbai and I did the Mixed Mag Lab there. It was a roaring success. We were building up to like, okay, we're going to come back to South Africa. We're going to do some more stuff in India. This is great. And then in March 2020, I don't know, everybody seemed to catch the flu or something happened. I can't remember exactly what it was, but there was something. So I found myself in a situation where me and my now ex-partner, pandemic stuff anyway, still on good terms though. Hello, Pauls. We'd taken house in Goa because she was an artist and she'd lived in Goa on and off. So we had this studio in Goa, beautiful big Portuguese house. Like we rented for a year for like the same price as a bloody 1 month's rent of the place in New York. It was that kind of madness.
Yeah.
And so we had this safe sanctuary, thank goodness, after literally being on 4 or 5 flights a month, flying all over the world, managing offices, literally sat in my loincloth in the jungle in Goa, slowly losing my mind for 2 years.
Why do you say losing your mind?
Well, not losing my mind. I mean, it was, you know, it was like everybody else. It's like, you know, pandemic stories. My board of directors were very kind, you know, to take a big pay cut like everybody. But, and I sat and we worked through it and I worked remotely. Probably worked harder during that time than any other, actually, because it was stressful. There was a lot of uncertainty. The pace of life for me was a massive, massive change. It's quite a workaholic, live wire, slightly, you know, borderline mentally ill kind of person anyway, you know, like quite obsessive about stuff. Now I'll just stopped, you know.
Forcing you to stop.
Yeah, and which in many ways was good, actually, because it required me to just take stock a little bit of like, because I've been working too hard and I was going to burn out and everything else. But also, like, India is, you know, Goa is lovely. Goa's beautiful. It was a great place to be. It was a big house. It was cheap to live. Like, I'll be forever grateful for the shelter that India gave us during that time. But it can be quite, India can be quite a difficult place to live as well. So when, A, the heat starts getting out of control, can't leave the house, can't go for a swim. I think the other thing is with the pandemic, I think everybody had their own thing that they needed to go through. But then I was dealing with stuff like really bad prickly heat to the point where I was like in agony, and I would spend, I'd get up, my entire time was spent just sat in front of a fan for like, that was for like a month. And then the monsoons came, and then shit gets really crazy because these old houses, like, you normally pack up your house and you leave for monsoon. So the damp, literally like snakes in the bed.
Snakes in the bed?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Monkeys, snakes in the garden. Had a couple of snakes. Woke up with a snake in the bed once. It's wild. We rode out the pandemic in Goa.
Yeah.
And then I managed to get some stuff going again. I did some mixed mang events in Goa, which is like us creeping out of the pandemic. And then the opportunity again came with Budweiser, God bless them. We're restarting activity. The Mixed Mag Lab collaboration that we did in 2019 is one of the best things we've ever done. Do you want to come back? And I'm like, I was already on the plane. I was like, yes. I arrived late March. Yeah, been here. We did a 10-week run. It finishes on Wednesday. It's been amazing. And yeah, hopefully after that, we're in talks with maybe doing some more, maybe next year, possibly going to do some more in India. But yeah, so this time, yeah, I've had a good almost 3 months.
Is there still a physical edition of the MixMag?
We had to suspend the print edition.
Okay.
In the pandemic, because it just wasn't viable. So we do digital covers, but we do one-offs as well. So sometimes we'll do a one-off Ibiza special. We'll do around some of the different sort of dance music conferences. But sadly, no. Currently, there isn't a monthly print edition anymore. However, never say never, because there may be an option to to relaunch that. But we focus mainly on a lot of video content, website, event stuff. We have 15 offices around the world. So there are print editions in some other territories. There's one in Brazil.
Okay.
There's one in Japan. Yeah, so there are some other print editions. But the main UK one is currently on a hiatus. But I can't talk too much about that. But when I go back to London in August, that is one of the things on the agenda. So we'll see.
It's interesting for me because Mix Mag is very much niche, and you had these UK magazines like Smash Hits Number One,
yeah,
which was about the pop music and was targeting what most people were buying, and they folded very quickly, and yet Mix Mag has been carrying on.
It's quite amazing, isn't it? I think, you know, underground and like niche kind of fans are more diehard, you know? Yeah. I think also as well that what happened for us, or what, from a business point of view, you know, dance music, electronic music started to get very big globally, particularly in the US. I mean, the explosion here is huge. It's exploding all over Africa, Asia, India. And as the kind of most authentic heritage brand, and I say that truthfully, we were in a good position to be able to do stuff like the Mixed Mag Lab, which isn't magazine content, but it's video content where you go, you know, it's video, it's streamed, it's with the sponsor, we make revenue, but we also get to do great content. I mean, I've been so lucky with the place. You know, I've got to put on these events and meet just the most amazing people in like LA, Miami, Detroit, Paris, London, Sydney, Mumbai, Goa, Johannesburg. You know, it's really, again, never take any of this stuff for granted. It's really quite amazing. But a lot of that is on the back of like, you know, dance music and DJ culture is rapidly becoming now. It's not really niche anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, a lot of the underground stuff maybe is, but Black Coffee could, you know, sell out a 50,000 stadium arena now if you wished.
Yeah.
He's Grammy nominated. He's just
Grammy won.
Sorry, Grammy won, yeah. Yes. Sorry. And just co-produced tracks with Drake. Drake just went behind the decks with him at Black Coffee's show in High in Ibiza. It's a big, big global scene now. So, you know, that's been good. Obviously, with the pandemic, that kind of knocked everybody sideways a bit, but it's just amazing to see all these events coming back and people traveling again and going to festivals and, yeah.
So like the Tomorrowlands and those type of festivals.
I mean, anything from, yeah, Tomorrowland to the smaller niche festivals to Lighthouse Festival. I co-founded a small boutique, like underground house music festival called SXM Festival, which is in the Caribbean. It's like half French, half Dutch island in the Caribbean called St. Martin or St. Martin.
Okay.
And so we just restarted this year again. And that was like, I mean, again, God, I'm lucky to get to go. That's like, it's just ridiculous. This island's beautiful. People fly in from the US. There's a lot, it's a big French culture there. So there's a lot of gastronomy. Beautiful and chic French people and very practical Dutch people on the Dutch side, you know.
And then you guys come along and cause chaos for a couple of days.
Basically, yeah. And it's like my partner, Julian, is a French Canadian of like North African descent. And he grew up in Montreal, which is an amazing city. Very culturally, really punches like above its weight. And his parents retired there and opened a hotel like a decade ago. Julian's very big. Julian Prince, very big in the dance music world. DJ, kind of entrepreneur, ran a bunch of nightclubs. And he just had this vision of like, because St. Martin's a little, it's not one of these super, super upscale, you know, St. Bart's type mega money type ones.
Yep.
But it's pretty well developed. It's got French culture. It's got a party infrastructure. And he was like, this could be like the Ibiza of the Caribbean. So that was the mission that we set out on 7 years ago. And hats off to him. He's kind of done it. Like the festival this year, there was nearly 10,000 people attended.
When was it?
It was in March.
Okay.
Yeah. And bear in mind as well, this festival, as it went through, there was a very, very severe hurricane at the end of 2017, Hurricane Irma.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Which literally flattened. It was terrible. It destroyed the island. So we went from being a festival to kind of a relief organization. And they were, the family and the festival were very much involved in the rebuilding effort, and had to cancel the 2018 edition. And then the 2020 edition happened early March. So that festival in 2020 was pretty crazy because a lot of people were already there. And
oh,
then,
wow.
Yeah.
Did they get stuck there?
Some people got stuck. It was nuts.
So at the festival, do you have DJs playing sets? Or?
Yeah. I mean, Black Coffee's, everybody, like, it's pretty amazing. Check it out, SXM Festival. Everybody, yeah, it's 5 days, multiple venues in different locations around the island. So it's like, it's more like a week in Ibiza than a festival. There's a main festival site.
Okay.
Which is on the beach, beautiful hidden lagoon. Jungle. There's no access apart from by foot normally, a private road. And then there's other venues dotted around the island. And people go for a week, they have a holiday there. So we had like, I don't know, like Black Coffee's played, Richie Horton, Dubfire, Nina Kravitz, Ricardo Villalobos, like every big name, Marco Carolla, they make a point of playing because it's pretty special. Yeah, this year was especially, we did a collaboration with a local steel band and they did like timpani steel pan versions of classic techno tracks.
Oh, wow.
It was incredible. Yeah, and then we work with the local community a lot for some community projects and stuff. So, yeah, no, it's pretty special. So that was great to see that and to have that happen again.
Now, tell us more about this organization.
Oh, The Great Oven.
Yes.
Okay. The Great Oven is, I guess this is my labor of love. It's a, I won't call it a charity. It's like a, we call it, it's a social movement. Basically, it was dreamed up by one of my best friends, a guy called James Thompson, who is he's quite well known in the UK food world. He's a chef. He's also a documentary maker, a writer. He's partner of a guy called Nigel Slater, who I don't know if how big now, but in the UK, Nigel Slater is a very, very recognized food author and cook.
Okay.
And he and I had had this idea of trying to build some kind of movement that comes together with food, music, and art, because they're like, for us, the core principles of like everything that's good about life. And James went and did it. And what we do is we create these giant community ovens. They're beautifully decorated and they act as public works of art, but they can feed 300 people a day.
Oh, wow.
And around that, he builds the staff in the kitchen. Musicians get involved to inspire people while they cook. And obviously there's all these beautiful artworks of how the ovens are decorated. All kinds of people from various marginalized communities, they would train and give skills and inspire through the ovens. And then the idea is the ovens act as these focal points of community cohesion. And then they get to open their own restaurants or they start their own business or they're inspired to whatever it is. So yeah, the organization is called The Great Oven. If you check on Instagram or just the website, yeah, this is one way that I feel I can pull all of those skills together and actually do something that, that matters. So, and that's great.
Your top five favorite songs by other artists, off the top of your head.
Oh my God, you can't ask me that question. Are you out of your mind?
I've been told, yes.
Oh, God, it's like asking to pick your favorite child.
First five that come to mind.
Okay, The Love Theme from Spartacus by an artist called Terry Callier. Window Licker by Aphex Twin. River Man by Nick Drake.
Two more.
Okay, As by Stevie Wonder. Finally, we'll have Finally by CC Peniston. Because I've got to represent some dance music. That's a little snapshot, but there are so many.
I know, that's God. Why I love this game.
I hate this game.
Everyone hates it, I love it. As a final message to our listening audience, what do you want to say to them?
Thanks for having me and allowing me to chat. Thanks to South Africa. I know you're global, but for providing a home again, and I'm looking forward to coming back. And I guess, what would I say? I guess the main thing is, I don't know, I hope some of this has amused you. Maybe it might inspire people, particularly young people, that, you know, you can go out and there are jobs in media and music and there are ways to do this and feel kind of creatively satisfied. I think the most important thing would be, please go and check out The Great Oven. We have an Instagram page. If you just search The Great Oven on Instagram or just search The Great Oven online, that truly is my labor of love. It's a really, really wonderful project. And yeah, any support there is, well, there are donations pages, but it's generally just about awareness of the project. And yeah, maybe you're a person out there that can help us. Maybe you're based in Colombia, or maybe you're based in Lebanon, or maybe there's something to do with the organization that chimes. If so, please reach out. And thank you.
So this is Celebs Vant signing out.